20. Lows tomorrow night near 37, and looking ahead to Thursday, sunny, highs near 64. Thanks for listening to KAXE. More news is next.
This is really just a pep talk. We have a very unified House, and we have a very unified Senate.
The president lobbied members of his own party today, trying to unify House Republicans while telling reporters there are no divisions.
It's Tuesday, May 20th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, some foreign manufacturers are finding ways around high tariffs.
The incentive for bad actors to act worse, or for previously good actors to try and skirt the law, the incentive is just increasing.
Also, Trump's pick to lead the IRS faces tough questions from Congress.
And Dawn Staley on what she learned from coaching South Carolina women's basketball.
I don't just thank God for the wins. I thank him for the losses, because the losses are the ones that really drive me.
Plus, the winner of NPR's College Podcast Challenge.
That's ahead. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Billionaire Elon Musk says he plans to cut back his political spending. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, Musk's spending in the 2024 presidential election for President Trump made him the country's top political donor.
In an interview with Bloomberg News at the Qatar Economic Forum, Musk said his days of funneling his wealth into politics may be behind him.
In terms of political spending, I'm going to do a lot less in the future.
And why is that?
I think I've done enough.
Musk spent nearly $300 million to support Trump for president, but some Republicans are beginning to see his support as a liability. He spent millions to back a Wisconsin Supreme Court judicial candidate who lost, and polls show Musk is far less popular than Trump. Musk did keep the door open to political spending, saying if there's a reason to resume it, he will. In recent weeks, Musk's prominence at the White House has faded, but he still does have the ear of Trump. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
President Trump traveled to Capitol Hill today to lobby on behalf of his so-called Big Beautiful Bill. Trump imploring House Republican lawmakers to put aside their internal differences over his tax cut and spending plan. Trump was upbeat, even as it remains unclear whether the multi-trillion dollar measure has the support ahead of a planned vote this week. The plan includes sweeping tax breaks and cuts to Medicaid, food stamps, and green energy programs. Israeli strikes have expanded across Gaza, Israel ordering a mass evacuation of civilians in southern Gaza as part of a widening offensive aimed at pressuring Hamas into releasing hostages. Here's NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi.
Thousands of Palestinians make their way out of Khan Yunis, dust rising from the destroyed streets. A man balances his children and suitcases on a horse-drawn cart. Israel's military says the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis is now designated a dangerous combat zone. Carrying a big yellow water can over his shoulders, Tahir al-Farra says he's desperate. No food, no drink, no education, no health, no medical care, he says. Just displacement, humiliation, destruction, and death every day. Ceasefire talks resumed this week, but broke down within 2 days. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News. Tel Aviv.
The FDA has announced plans to limit access to COVID vaccines. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The FDA says that it plans to impose new requirements on COVID vaccines to focus on immunizing people at highest risk for serious complications from COVID. That would include people who are age 65 and older and younger people with other health problems. For children and younger healthy adults, the FDA wants vaccine companies to conduct additional research to demonstrate the safety and effectiveness of the vaccines. The FDA says the moves are necessary to restore trust in the vaccines. Critics say the moves are unnecessary because the vaccines are very safe and effective, and they would limit the ability of younger, healthy people to get vaccinated. Rob Stein, NPR News.
This is NPR. Southwest Airlines says it wants passengers to begin keeping their portable chargers in plain sight while using them. The move comes amid concerns about the rising number of lithium battery fires. There have already been 19 this year. The airline cites the growing number of devices powered by lithium-ion batteries. It says the new policy will take effect later this month. A summer reading list that included made-up book titles by famous authors has appeared in major newspapers. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the list was generated by AI and was a piece of fiction in its own right.
Percival Everett never wrote a book called The Rainmakers, and Isabel Allende never wrote a book called Tidewater Dreams. But both of those fake titles and descriptions of them appeared on a summer reading list published in the Chicago Sun-Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer. The list of mostly fake books set off a wave of angry comments on social media. This is the future of book recommendations when libraries are defunded and dismantled, lamented author and editor Kelly Jensen. The list didn't have a byline and came from content licensed from King Features, a unit of Hearst Newspapers. But writer Marco Buscaglia has claimed responsibility for it. Huge mistake on my part, he tells NPR in an email. The fake list got published 2 months after about 20% of staff at the Chicago Sun-Times took buyouts. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Actor George Wendt, best known for playing Norm on the NBC sitcom Cheers, has died. In a statement sent by his publicist, Wendt's family confirmed his death, saying he died in his sleep. George Wendt was 76 years old. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's 6 minutes after 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Lows tonight, 37 to 41 with a chance of showers and about a 50% chance of showers tomorrow morning. Highs 53 to 60.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump traded the White House this morning for Capitol Hill to push House Republicans to unite on what he calls one big beautiful bill. That's legislation that includes massive tax cuts, spending cuts, deregulation, and immigration changes. Republicans have struggled for weeks to finish work on the bill thanks to rebellions within their own ranks. But that's not how the president described things on his way into the meeting.
This is really just a pep talk. We have a very unified House, and we have a very unified Senate.
We're joined by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith and congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt to talk through this. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Ari.
We've talked a lot about the challenges with getting unity on this bill. Members are split on everything from tax breaks to cuts to Medicaid, not to mention the deficit. So, Barbara, what were House leaders hoping to achieve with this personal appearance by the president?
You know, I heard more times than I can count this morning outside that meeting members saying there's no salesman like President Trump. No one does it like he does. And I think that's the point of the president coming to the meeting. Up until now, for this particular legislative exercise, he's not been on the phone calling members all the time the way that we've seen him do in the past. In fact, the chairman of a key committee said the other day that the president has shown a lot of deference to the speaker and members to work this out. Obviously, he stepped in a much bigger way today coming here, not to negotiate any specifics of the bill, but to lean on the holdouts and energize the conference overall to get it done.
So, Tam, how did he make the case?
He said there was no shouting, and he said that he wasn't losing patience, but he essentially told the three different groups of holdouts to get over their concerns. He didn't leave the impression that he's deeply immersed in the nitty-gritty details or even the specifics of what is in the current version of the bill. But he went in saying Republicans were more united than ever. He came out saying it was a meeting of love.
There's great unity in that room, and it's the biggest tax cut in American history. And if it doesn't pass, everybody's going to get a 68% tax increase.
Now, that math there is a bit overstated, but Trump is making it clear to House Republicans who were on the ballot with him last year when he campaigned on this that failure isn't an option. And he is already threatening one House GOP holdout, saying that he should be voted out of office. And he appears to be betting that ultimately this forces others to get to yes.
Barbara, can you tell whether the lobbying worked? Were the holdouts convinced?
You know, convinced might be a little premature. I did not expect the holdouts to leave that room and immediately flip saying, yes, now we're on board. But there was, I would say, a softening from some members who had previously expressed concerns about the bill. Tennessee Congressman Tim Burchett, a member of the Freedom Caucus, was skeptical about the bill. But here's what he had to say as he left the meeting, which he called very positive and uplifting.
It's like an NBA ball game, boys. Wait till the last 2 minutes and watch it. And we're about at 2 minutes and 30 seconds right now. I think there'll be a little arm twisting, a little gnashing of teeth, but I think the president will deliver like he always does. Don't count him out.
But not everyone is showing signs of eventually getting on board. One main group that has problems with this bill are blue state Republicans, who are pushing to lift the cap on the deduction for state and local taxes, SALT. New York Congressman Mike Lawler is one of them. He said it's one of the biggest issues impacting his constituents, and he's not going to budge on his demands from leadership to adjust that cap, regardless of what Trump has to say. And, you know, the margins are really tight here, so there really isn't room for even a small number of defections.
Tam, how would you describe Trump's relationship with Congress?
He has been in very regular contact with House Speaker Mike Johnson and with the Senate Majority Leader about how the bill is taking shape, about what's possible, what isn't possible. Early on, he insisted that his entire agenda be packaged into this one bill. But since then, he's been more focused on getting a win than getting into the details or brokering a deal between these various factions. And as one Republican House member put it, the president's message today was forceful. Quit screwing around and get this passed. I talked to two former aides who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to describe private conversations. They both told me that when Trump gets members on the phone, it is very hard for them to say no. Though one of them also told me that the White House and congressional leadership were leaning too heavily on Trump's power of persuasion and not doing enough of the behind-the-scenes work to move lawmakers, like getting local leaders to lobby them or sending members of the cabinet to their district to make the case for the bill.
Well, how soon are we going to know whether this succeeded?
We won't have to wait that long. The next step is for this to go to the Rules Committee, which is set to meet in the very early hours tomorrow morning. And the Speaker wants to have a vote on this by Thursday latest. He wants the House to wrap this up before Memorial Day, because as much as the drama around the negotiations have been in the House side, this still has to get through the Senate. And it's been the subject of a lot of angst up here on the Hill, because senators have been really vocal already about the major problems that they have with the bill, how they need to make big adjustments to it in order for it to get enough support to pass the chamber. So this is still a long drama ahead.
What Barbara's saying is this is just the beginning.
NPR's Tamara Keith and Barbara Sprunt, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Joe Strogatz is a 23-year-old asking herself the kinds of questions people her age often do, like, is this person the one for me? What do I need out of romantic relationships?
Sometimes I wonder, would I be happy? Would I be fulfilled if I just had friendships for the rest of my life?
That is an excerpt from Joe Strogatz's podcast, Just Friends. And today we are announcing that out of hundreds of entries, hers is the grand prize winner of NPR's College Podcast Challenge. NPR's Janaki Mehta met her in Portland, Maine.
Welcome to Portland, Maine!
When you talk to Joe, you hear the wide open world inside the brain of a young 20-something. But you also hear the uncertainties of the life ahead of her.
In college, I spent a long time trying to date people and convincing myself that I was happy doing it and just not finding people that were actually a match for me.
After she got a music degree at Tufts University, Jo moved to Portland to continue her education at the SALT Institute for Documentary Studies. We met her in the same room where she took a podcasting class that led her to follow her curiosities.
So then I started wondering if there's anybody, there had to be. There had to be somebody out there that felt fulfilled by their friendships and maybe their sex life, but not in the traditional path we think of.
That's when she found the main character for her podcast, Steve Small.
I have been single my whole adult life. I have never been in a romantic relationship.
And Steve told Joe that he's truly happy that way. In her winning podcast, she takes us through Steve's life.
Steve is in his 60s. He's a great conversationalist.
How living through the AIDS epidemic shaped his identity as a gay man. How he learned that love didn't have to look one way. And Joe, who's a musician and composer, didn't just hear Steve's life story. She heard something else.
The way that he told his story felt like music to me. And it made me realize that storytelling can be music. And
we asked her to tell us what she meant, or to sing us what she meant.
So the beginning is kind of like, ha, 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 ha. I like like to use my voice as an instrument to make these sorts of noises without lyrics.
Joe says she'd play back Steve's words and she'd compose as she listened to him.
And I sat down at the piano live and just played what I was feeling, inspired by his words.
And I thought, I can either be single and happy or together and stuck.
So have you ever felt romance with somebody?
No, I have not. Is that sad?
I don't know. Do you think it's sad?
No, it's not sad for me. I only know my life the way that it has been. I have to say that my friendships are 100 times more important to me. My friendships are the closest thing I have to a marriage.
It was how Steve's words inspired the music and also how they made me feel. But I had some other fun songs in there and trying to remember. I wanted the upright bass to be like, oh, we're going on a journey back in time. And then I have these harmonies come in. And yeah, I wanted this whole song to feel like we're going through puberty, and this is weird.
Joe's original compositions are part of what made her entry stand out to our judges. So producer Janet Wujong Lee and I hopped in the car with Joe to drive an hour south to meet Steve in his hometown, Newmarket, New Hampshire.
Steve.
Joe held her framed grand prize certificate close to her chest until we arrived.
There he is.
Steve, look at Isn't this crazy?
It's a very official plaque.
It is. Oh, no, that's great.
We sat down with Steve at this cozy cafe where he once worked as a teenager, a place where he made lifelong friendships. We asked him how listening back to Joe telling his story made him think about where he is now.
People ask me a lot, are you still single? And I'll say yes, and they'll go, aw. They'll kind of tilt their head, and I'm like, no, single suits me. It gives you a lot of time to figure out who you are, who you want to be. Then the partner you find, when you do or if you do, will be more right for you.
So. Joe, what are you thinking as you hear that? How does that make you think about how you might navigate your life and your friendships?
It makes me think that I would be doing myself a favor if I stopped caring earlier on. Like, I think you inspire me in the way that you are just completely yourself and you do what you want to do. And I hope that I live my life like that too.
You'll get there.
That was Steve Small and Joe Strogatz. She's the grand prize winner of NPR's College Podcast Challenge. You can listen to Just Friends on NPR.org. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hi, I'm Michael Goldberg, host of our weekly mix of story and song, Stay Human. I hope you can join us at a special live storytelling event at Bemidji Brewing, Tuesday, May 20th. The theme is Where I Come From, and we'll hear from Terry O'Brien, Leif Wallin, Susie Saxhog-Loeffler, Scott Stoll, and Anne-Marie Newman. With Watermark Arts Center and support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, come raise a glass to great storytelling in good company. Music from John Henningsgaard starts at 6 p.m., storytelling at 7, free admission, everyone welcome, and we'll have an open mic following our guest storytellers. So if you'd like to tell us about where you come from, please do. Tuesday, May 20th at Bemidji Brewing. See you there.
That event happening tonight. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 519. Coming up at 530, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. And we thank Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Weather tonight, chance of showers, cloudy, lows 37 to 41, and tomorrow 50% chance of showers, especially in the morning, highs 53 to 60, and breezy east winds 10 to 20. Support for KAXE comes from Itasca Life Options, presenting their original play, Mayhem on Main Stage, Friday, May 23rd at noon at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids, featuring the ILO Players, a troupe of actors of all abilities. Open to all, more information at rifecenter.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Total Wine & More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The U.S. has imposed a whole lot more tariffs. Collecting those tariffs is another matter. As NPR's Emily Fang reports, cuts to government spending could be undercutting enforcement efforts.
David Rashid runs an auto parts company based in Illinois. Chinese companies are his biggest competitors. So back in 2019, he welcomed the 25% tariffs President Trump put on China during his first term.
After Trump's 25% tariffs hit, what we realized was the price didn't change. And so that put me on a path to try to understand how that was possible.
It turns out Chinese manufacturers were routing their product through third countries like Thailand and Vietnam to avoid paying tariffs. This problem is called transshipping, and trade experts say conditions now are ripe for more of it.
There is going to be more incentive for companies to attempt to skirt the law.
This is Matt Lappin, a trade compliance attorney. What he means is tariffs on a country like China are still really high, at least 30% on most imports. But current tariffs are lower on other countries, like Turkey, especially after President Trump paused some tariff hikes on most countries except for China. So if you're a Chinese exporter selling to the U.S., the incentive to transship through a third country just went up.
The incentive for bad actors to act either worse or for otherwise previously good actors to try and skirt the law, the incentive is just increasing.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, is the primary federal agency which screens imports and determines if a tariff should be collected. But it now has a lot more work to do. On top of global retaliatory and reciprocal tariffs, they're also in charge of collecting a new tax starting this month on the more than 1 billion low-value packages that come into the U.S. each year, mostly from Chinese e-commerce platforms. The agency said in a statement to NPR that, quote, as a result of recent presidential actions, enforcement will include the most severe penalties permitted by law. But the union, which represents Customs and Border Protection agents, says CBP's workforce has long suffered from understaffing and warns the agency is also facing a surge in planned retirement soon.
CBP does not have the resources to effectively inspect and enforce it.
This is Ram Bensian. He sells software to governments, mostly in Europe, to help them monitor trade fraud. As for what he's observed so far in the U.S.,
I think that there is no capacity in terms of workforce, in terms of skill set, in terms of supporting technologies to allow such a massive volume.
A former senior enforcement official at CBP who requested anonymity because they were not authorized to speak about their previous job told NPR there is a chronic shortage of import specialists at the agency, meaning a lot of fraud goes undetected. So what to do if one does suspect someone is evading tariffs? Ask Milton Magnus. He runs M&B Hangers, a family wire hanger business based in Alabama, an American industry decimated by Chinese competitors. Magnus says they were sneaking their product through other routes.
So we actually sent an investigator, posed as American hanger bomb, to Taiwan and Vietnam.
Magnus says these investigators he paid documented how the addresses in Taiwan and Vietnam were just shipping basically the same product from China. Magnus then sent this evidence of some 30 trade violations to the Department of Homeland Security.
They didn't respond a single one.
This was more than a decade ago. Since then, he's had to file more trade complaints to little effect. Because although he supports tariffs, each time a new one goes into effect, Magnus says he gets a reprieve of just a few months. Then the offending company just transships through another country.
People don't get caught. If they get caught, there's no punishment for it. And they just go somewhere else and do it again.
But there is currently a government-wide hiring freeze and a mandate to cut the federal budget, initiatives championed by President Trump. Plus, a key Justice Department trade fraud effort that once coordinated major trade investigations is now leaderless after its head resigned.
My sense is that nobody's running it today.
That's Rashid, the Illinois entrepreneur. He argues not being able to prosecute trade crimes hurts businesses, but also the U.S. government in terms of lost revenue.
There's a lot of money being left on the table is the bottom line.
A lot of money in existing tariffs not being collected. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
In Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia, communities are beginning to pick up the pieces and assess their needs after violent storms and tornadoes ripped through those states over the weekend, killing more than two dozen people. After a disaster, communities often receive tons of donated supplies to help with recovery. When Hurricane Helene devastated western North Carolina last fall, it took an army of volunteers to get those supplies to the people who needed them. As part of our series, Here to Help, Blue Ridge Public Radio's Laura Hackett shares the story of one of those volunteers.
7 months after the storm, there's still plenty of work to do in western North Carolina. It's one of the areas hardest hit by Hurricane Helene. Many people are still struggling here. Clara Carrias is one volunteer who has risen to the challenge. When I stopped by the headquarters of the nonprofit Beloved Asheville, she's with a group of volunteers packing up bags of donated food.
I love volunteer. I love help people. And always I'm trying to make time to maybe 2 hours, 3 hours, helping them.
As a mother of three, a part-time cook at McDonald's, and an immigrant studying English, to carve out a few hours a week to volunteer is no small feat. Sometimes when she doesn't have babysitting available, she just brings her kids along.
My oldest daughter, she's 11 years old. She say, oh, I like it. I want to make some bags for children. She loved that.
As a native Spanish speaker from Mexico, Carrias brought supplies to Latino communities after the storm. It proved extra valuable when landslides and debris cut off entire neighborhoods.
The first days, it was so hard, you know. Trees over everywhere, a lot of damage everywhere. The roads sometimes are difficult to get homes, but always we try to go there.
She drove on treacherous mountain roads to bring people care packages of food, water, cleaning supplies, and anything else they asked for. And she did it while she was dealing with her own storm damage at home.
A tree fell over a house and one bedroom was damaged.
Then a team of fellow volunteers rebuilt her house for free.
When they done, we are so happy, you know.
It's a moment that stuck with her. And it's this reason that she still volunteers to this day.
She's got the hearts and the brain.
That's Reverend Amy Cantrell, who helps run the nonprofit. She says Carrias is great at logistics.
Many, many people, including Clara, who really suffered the worst of the storm, started showing up here in the midst of all that devastation.
A wave of support, she says, grew quickly.
And it was just incredibly inspiring. Many of them joining in with the hundreds of volunteers that were coming here, both locally and from all over the country.
Volunteers made a big difference, feeding people, rebuilding houses, and cleaning up debris. And as Western North Carolina continues to recover, Cantrell says volunteers are still needed. For NPR News, I'm Laura Hackett in Asheville.
To tell us a story from your volunteer life or nominate someone else, visit npr.org and search Here to Help.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Up ahead, it is the Up North Report, local news from our region. Chance of showers tonight, cloudy, lows 37 to 41, and a 50% chance of showers tomorrow morning, then highs 53 to 60 and breezy east winds. Support comes from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. It's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Authorities are investigating what they say is a suspicious death in Bemidji. Larissa Donovan has the details.
According to our release from Bemidji Police Chief Mike Mastin, officers responded to the 1300 block of America Avenue Monday evening to a report of a gas leak. As officers arrived, they reportedly smelled a strong odor near the Courtyard Apartments building and located an adult woman and young child, along with a dead man inside one of the apartments. Law enforcement then worked to evacuate other residents while Bemidji Ambulance attended to victims and Bemidji firefighters worked on the potential leak. Minnesota Energy Resources, the city's natural gas provider, also responded and determined there was not a leak. The man's cause of death remains under investigation. The woman and child found in the apartment with the man were taken to the Sanford Health Hospital for treatment. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Wind gusts reaching 50 miles per hour or more and humidity dropping to 15 to 20% prompted a red flag warning and extreme fire danger conditions on Tuesday in northern Minnesota. Those conditions prompted additional preparation by wildland firefighters battling the large Jenkins Creek and Cookhouse fires. The Eastern Area Incident Management Team says that firefighting crews increased the containment lines of the Camp House fire on Monday to 59%. For the Jenkins Creek fire, which is just 6% contained, more crews were assigned to the western side in the event of flare-ups. On social media, St. Louis County Sheriff Gordon Ramsey detailed at least three small fires that started Tuesday, some sparked by downed power lines in the high winds. They have since been knocked down.
Obviously, these winds are significant and may have an impact on some of the success that we've been having.
About 150 people attended a community meeting about the fires in Aurora on Monday night. Incident management team member Micah Bell explained that the goal is always to get the fire out as quickly as possible.
Sometimes we have to wait for the fire to come to us just because we need to catch it in the right spot. It's not because we're trying to let it burn intentionally in your woods.
Assistant Regional Forestry Manager for the DNR, Matt Wappler, commended local first responders who are fighting fires in their own backyards.
That really wears a lot on you as a firefighter, as a first responder. So I do want to just encourage you, as time goes on, with the emotion of these incidents, make sure you reach out to someone.
More changes to evacuation levels and road closures were announced by the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office on Monday. Go to KAXE.org for more information. A narrowly divided legislature adjourned Monday without completing a state budget for the next 2 years, ending the session just as it began, with rancorous finger-pointing. The Minnesota Reformer reports the biggest budget bills are still outstanding, including health and human services, education, and taxes. The legislature only passed 9 budget and policy bills out of some 20 in process, meaning a special session will need to occur. Given the Republican refusal to agree to any new tax revenue, lawmakers are looking to trim spending. The date of the special legislative session has yet to be announced, though lawmakers say it ideally would be before Memorial Day. In a series of press conferences, lawmakers laid the blame on each other for failing to finish their work. The state will be obligated to send layoff notices to state employees if there is no budget by June 1st. Minnesota Power is hosting a series of open houses this week where members of the public can learn about the company's proposed 63-mile-long, 345-kilovolt transmission line. The line would run from its Iron Range substation near Grand Rapids to its St. Louis County substation near Hermantown. The project is one in a portfolio of transmission projects approved by the regional grid operator intended to enhance grid reliability. Open houses are scheduled for 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday in Floodwood, noon to 2 p.m. Thursday in Hermantown, and 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday in Solway. May is Maternal Mental Health Month, and St. Louis County Public Health is highlighting resources available for new and expectant parents who may be struggling. The county has launched a new campaign to remind parents that they are not alone and that help is available. Signs and flyers direct people to a new website, northlandperinatalresources.org. A special Northland March for Moms and Dads is scheduled for 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Thursday at Olcott Park in Virginia. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank. Part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump's pick to lead the IRS faced tough questions today during his Senate confirmation hearing. Lawmakers quizzed former Congressman Billy Long about his qualifications for the job. It was also a chance to ask about the direction of one of the most powerful and most feared government agencies. Committee Chair Mike Crapo set the tone for the hearing, noting that a lot of taxpayers regard the IRS as the enemy.
Americans consistently rate it as one of the least favorable federal agencies, notwithstanding the fact that nearly all Americans must interact with it.
Yes, indeed, we must. Well, NPR's Scott Horsley was monitoring the hearing today. He's here now. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you.
Okay, so before we get to just what happened today, give us the backdrop here, because there's been a lot going on at the IRS.
Yeah, President Trump has ordered widespread layoffs at the tax collection agency. He's also threatened to use the IRS to punish political enemies by taking away their tax-exempt status. And he's trying to harness tax data to locate and deport people who are living in the country illegally. So while all this is happening, the IRS has churned through four different acting commissioners over the last 4 months, and Republicans in Congress are trying to unwind some of what the IRS did during the Biden administration. So it all made for a lively hearing.
Just packed a lot in there. I want to tick through a few things one by one. Start with the layoffs. You said they're widespread. How widespread?
Yeah, the tax collector has cut more than 11,000 jobs this year, including nearly a third of its auditors. And more layoffs are expected now that the tax filing season is behind us. Those cuts are going to make it hard for the IRS just to answer the telephone, let alone go after wealthy tax cheats. New Hampshire Senator Maggie Hassan asked Billy Long if he would commit to rolling back some of those staffing cuts.
Customer service at the IRS in New Hampshire is worse today than it was several months ago.
I don't think having worse customer service is acceptable.
It's not, and it takes people to provide customer service.
Now, Long did not commit to restoring any jobs at the IRS, but he did say he'd work closely with IRS staffers, and in fact, he promised to come into work 90 minutes early every day just to hear what the workforce is thinking.
Meanwhile, as you know, President Trump has threatened to take away tax breaks from universities, from other nonprofit groups. Did Long weigh in on that?
Yes. The president's threatened to strip Harvard and other universities of their tax-free status because he says they haven't done enough to fight anti-Semitism. But, you know, after Richard Nixon tried to use the IRS to go after his political enemies back in the 1970s, Congress passed laws explicitly barring the president and his staff from doing that. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren tried repeatedly to get Long to say it's illegal for the president to order the IRS around like that, but Long would not go quite that far.
If I say I'm going to follow the law, why would you need to ask me the question?
Well, because I want to make sure that you understand what the law says. If you think follow the law means you just get to make it up on the spot, then, bud, don't get to be the IRS commissioner.
Scott Horsley, to the questions about taxpayer data, the privacy of taxpayers' information, did that come up today?
It did. And, you know, this reflects also the legacy of the Richard Nixon era. After Watergate, Congress passed laws setting strict limits on who can have access to taxpayers' information. And so when Elon Musk's team tried to tap into that IRS database, there were a lot of protests and legal challenges. And Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico pressed Long about that today.
Do you believe the Department of Government Efficiency should have access to my constituents' private taxpayer data?
I don't think that anyone's taxpayer data should be released to anyone that doesn't need it for legitimate purposes.
I appreciate
that. The IRS.
We are still testing what the limits of legitimate purposes are, though. For example, the IRS agreed to share tax information with immigration officials, and opponents are challenging that deal in court.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
Great to be with you.
Venezuelans living in the U.S. are shocked by a Supreme Court decision handed down yesterday. It immediately strips temporary protected status, known as TPS, from hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans. A legal fight over the Trump administration order ending TPS is now playing out in other federal courts. But NPR's Greg Allen reports Venezuelans living in Florida are worried that they might be deported back to a country mired in economic and political turmoil.
Cecilia Gonzalez Herrera came to the U.S. from Venezuela with her parents 8 years ago after her family was targeted by the administration of authoritarian leader Nicolas Maduro.
Due to the political persecution my parents were facing, both of my parents were very vocal against the Maduro regime. My dad was an attorney. My mom was a political science specialist.
Gonzalez is one of the plaintiffs who challenged an order issued in January by the Trump administration ending TPS for about 350,000 Venezuelans. A U.S. district judge in San Francisco put the administration order on hold while he heard the case, and an appeals court agreed with that decision. In an unsigned order, the Supreme Court intervened, stripping TPS immediately from a group of Venezuelans whose status expired in April. For those people, Adelise Ferro, executive director of the Venezuelan American Caucus, says there may be immediate consequences.
Because of that, the work permits that are linked to their TPS are expired. Because of that, their driver's license are also expired, unless they have some other immigration benefit.
Cecilia Gonzalez lives in Central Florida and is part of a group of Venezuelans whose temporary protected status expires in September. Along with her parents, she applied for political asylum when she arrived here 8 years ago. If she loses TPS, she says, she and many other Venezuelans will press their case for asylum.
Which pretty much means that we will be in this limbo that we have been waiting 8 years or more time, waiting for an interview to be called. Which is the reality of many other Venezuelans who have also filed for political asylum.
In its court filings, the Trump administration says TPS is no longer needed for Venezuelans because economic and political conditions have improved there. Ferro says that's simply not true. And she says a travel advisory issued just last week by the U.S. State Department confirms it.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio, through his department, published a travel warning for U.S. citizens going to Venezuela or being in Venezuela and ask them to leave the country immediately.
The advisory warns of, quote, arbitrary enforcement of local laws, crime, civil unrest, and poor health infrastructure. Gonzalez says there is some remorse among Venezuelans who voted for Trump, some of whom now see his actions lifting TPS as a betrayal. But it's a reminder, she says, that elections matter.
During the campaign, Trump was very open about his plans for immigration, including Venezuelans. That some Venezuelans who supported him may now look surprised and be like, I didn't know he meant us, or I didn't thought he was going to come for us. But he meant it, and he's doing it.
Despite its impact on Florida's large Venezuelan community, reaction to the Supreme Court order and Trump's push to lift TPS has been muted among Republican elected officials here. Maria Alvira Salazar, a member of Congress from Miami, who's positioned herself as an advocate of Venezuelans and a Trump supporter, said she's deeply disappointed with the court's decision. Greg Allen, NPR News, Doral, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Early this morning in Geneva, the members of the World Health Organization made history. They voted overwhelmingly to adopt the first ever pandemic agreement. The vote came after more than 3 years of negotiations. And the United States was a key player in those talks, but no longer. Here in the studio is NPR Global Health correspondent Jonathan Lambert. Hey there.
Hi, Ari.
Why do all these countries think the world needs a pandemic agreement?
Well, if you remember, a lot went wrong during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah.
Healthcare workers were rationing protective equipment, and once vaccines came, rich countries got them months and months before poor countries did. So this agreement, sometimes called a treaty, was really born out of that, of public health experts around the world trying to figure out what went wrong and how we can do better next time. But it was getting all these countries to agree was a really contentious process, and there were points when it seemed dead in the water.
Yeah, 3 years, but it did ultimately pass. So what's the reaction, Ben?
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement, and it's a big milestone. Here's how WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus put it.
With this agreement, we're better prepared for a pandemic than any generation in history.
But look, it's not perfect. It lacks tough enforcement mechanisms, and there are still big questions about how it will be funded. But it's a start.
What's actually in the treaty?
So overall, it's really an effort to get all these countries on the same page, working together. The document is 30 pages long, and some of it is focused on preventing pandemics, so trying to limit animal viruses from spilling over into humans or boosting lab biosecurity. And a lot of it is focused on, once there is a pandemic, how do we respond? How do we make sure that healthcare workers don't run out of masks or manufacturers have what they need to make tests and vaccines? But there are still some very contentious details that couldn't be resolved. Countries agreed to basically kick the can down the road on those, and they have a year to finish.
What are some of those contentious details?
Basically, who gets vaccines and treatments and when. During COVID, wealthy countries like the U.S. were often giving out booster shots before poorer countries had even vaccinated a fraction of their most vulnerable population. Hmm. Some research suggests that more than 1 million people died because of that disparity. This treaty is trying to solve that. It will require wealthy countries to share medicines and vaccines with low- and middle-income countries. And in exchange, those countries will share health data required to make those medicines and vaccines, like genetic sequences from pathogens. That's been tough to negotiate because richer countries want to protect their pharmaceutical industries, and low-income countries don't necessarily want to just give away all their data for nothing.
And for all this, the U.S. is not at the table.
That's right. The U.S. had helped draft the treaty, but because of the Trump administration's withdrawal from WHO, the U.S. is no longer part of it. And this really worries Lawrence Gostin. He's a global health law expert at Georgetown.
If we're not part of it, it's hard for me to see how the United States gets rapid access to the scientific information we need to really develop vaccines and treatments. And that could be a problem for every American.
And a lot of people think that without the participation of the U.S. as a pharmaceutical giant, the treaty will just be less effective. On the other hand, the rest of the world could rally in America's absence. We'll just have to see.
That's NPR's Jonathan Lambert. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock tonight, Sara, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. There is a red flag warning in effect until 9 o'clock tonight for north central and northeastern Minnesota. Any fires that ignite will be difficult to control. Chance of showers overnight, cloudy, lows 37 to 41, and 50% chance of showers tomorrow morning, highs 53 to 60, and breezy east winds 10 to 20. For Thursday, sunny and highs near 64. We receive support from North Holmes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northholmes.org. And we thank Beltrami County Historical Society in Bemidji, offering 6 days of real talk about periods during Menstruation Health Week, May 26th through May 31st, with a special museum exhibit, documentary screenings, author talks, and a community period product drive. Details at beltramihistory.org/period. White Earth Tribal and Community College in Manoman hosts Earth Summit 2025, May 28th and 29th. The event strives to incorporate scientific information and Ojibwe traditions to understand environmental challenges. Learn more and register at wetcc.edu. The Itasca Youth Orchestra performs tomorrow night, 5:30, at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. Tickets at itascaorchestra.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Today, people know Dawn Staley as a resident of South Carolina. In fact, there's now a new statue of her in Columbia, where she's coached the University of South Carolina women's basketball team to 3 national championships, following her own Hall of Fame career as a player. But if you ask her, she'd tell you she's from Philadelphia.
I grew up in the projects, and if you weren't from my neighborhood, you would probably think it's probably the worst place to raise children. Whereas if you were from the neighborhood, you felt like you needed and wanted nothing.
She says that the community at what's now known as the Raymond Rosen Manor created as nurturing an environment as anywhere, including some tough love.
If you were outside of your household and an adult in the neighborhood saw you do something that was not appropriate, they had the honor and privilege to put us back in line.
As a college basketball coach, Dawn Staley is now often the adult figure in the room. She's written a new memoir called Uncommon Favor, Basketball, North Philly, My Mother, and the Life Lessons I Learned from All 3. She's doing interviews about it on top of the other media responsibilities that come with her job. But she says she grew up an introvert.
When you are the youngest of 5, and it was 7 of us living in a, 3-bedroom row home. You were me. I was the lowest on the totem pole. Like, I couldn't say anything. Even if I did have a voice, I don't even think it would have been heard. So quite naturally, I was quiet and I observed a lot. And I think it's helped me out throughout my career from just growing up in a project to now, where talking is a big part of my job. And now I found myself over talking, and that's a weird dynamic to me.
You joined South Carolina as head coach back in 2008, and I know that your mother grew up in the state of South Carolina in the 1940s and the 50s, when things certainly looked a whole lot different than they do now. I just wonder, could you have ever imagined that you would have ended up putting down roots, making a life and a career in that state?
I could not. Like, my mother left this state. She went to a butchery to get some meat. You know, the butcher was giving her meat that seemed to be spoiled. Mm. And my mother asked him if he could go to the back and get some fresh meat. And the butcher was like, you're going to take this meat and that's all you're going to get. So my mother, even at 13, 14 years old, she said, I'm not taking that home. And the butcher said, get out of my store. Never come back in here. And back in that time, those were threatening words to Black people. That meant that you need to get out of town. So my grandmother packed my mother up, sent her up north. I mean, she spent over 50 years in Philly. And then I bring her this professional move of mine, taking the job at the University of South Carolina. And at first, my mother didn't want to go. I don't know if it was just because of what forced her to go to Philly, but all her siblings were still here in South Carolina. So she ended up coming down. You know, my mother passed away in 2017, and the 9 years that she was able to spend here in South Carolina with her siblings, our family, it couldn't happen a better way.
Switching gears a bit here, in the book, you chronicle in significant detail the push that you made to be paid equally to South Carolina's men's basketball coach. And that's a victory that makes you, as you write, the highest paid Black female coach ever. I just want to hear from you in your words. How significant is that to you? And why is that push so important to talk so openly about?
Well, the push is important, not necessarily for me and my bank account, because prior to me asking for equal pay, I was making a whole lot of money. So I was pretty comfortable with it. It was the sole principle of the success that I've had here at South Carolina versus my male counterpart. And there was a series of things that I did to ensure that it would take place. One of them was asking my agent that I still have, I asked him to stand down just for this negotiation process,
right,
of asking for equal pay. And I hired a lawyer. So he believed in it. It took 6 months to get it, but it was a fight worth fighting, not just for me, just for the next coach. So, you know, if I can be a beacon of hope for other women in different professions, I'd like to be that.
I do want to ask you about some of what has happened on the court. People may not remember that when you got to South Carolina, success did not come instantly. The first two seasons were losing seasons. How does one go about building a championship caliber program essentially from scratch?
I think it takes losing sometimes. I do think it takes you being, and I wouldn't necessarily say humbled, but it takes you sometimes to lose, to see where you are, to see what you need to work for, to see the type of talent that you need to bring in. You need culture. You need chemistry. You need all those things that really take time. Although I thought it was professional suicide during those times of my first 2 or 3 years here in South Carolina, now as I reflect on it, it was exactly what I needed when I needed it.
In the book, you talk about yourself as being a sore loser to this day, but you write that you can handle loss better today because you can identify why you lost. And I know that you and your team recently suffered a big loss in the NCAA championship game. I'm not going to ask you to relive that game, but big picture, what did that loss teach you?
You know, here's the thing. I think when you've won national championships, like we've been a part of three that we've won, you know when you're the more dominant team. To be quite honest, the way that UConn was playing, they were the most dominant team, and they displayed that throughout the entire tournament. So to lose to UConn in that fashion, obviously it hurt. But then you understand and you see everything that has happened in my life, whether it's winning or losing, are things and experiences that are supposed to happen. So I don't just thank God for the wins. I thank him for the losses because the losses are the ones that really drive me.
You've now led the team at South Carolina for 17 seasons, those three national championships. What does the future hold for you?
You know, everything that I'm doing at this point in my career and my life is being a dream merchant for young people. I'm all into our team success because that means my players are able to fulfill lifelong dreams like I had. And because I've been a part of multiple national championships and multiple gold medal games, I'm able to help them. I'm here to give them everything that I have to make sure their success comes a lot sooner than my success.
We've been talking with Coach Dawn Staley of the University of South Carolina. Her memoir is Uncommon Favor, Basketball, North Philly, My Mother, and the Life Lessons I Learned from All Three. Coach Staley, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9, and you may find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much. Our weather for tonight, we do have a chance of showers, cloudy skies, lows 37 to 41, and 50% chance of showers tomorrow morning, then highs 53 to 60 and breezy east winds 10 to 20. Lows tomorrow night near 37 and 430.